Our meeting will come to order, please. We do not yet have a quorum. Members, we have permanent pages now, so I'd like to call them to the testifying table and introduce themselves to us. Tell us a little bit about themselves. They have some interesting past and future plans. So please come forward, gentlemen.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Have a seat, please. Both of you. We're waiting for some members, so I'm killing time, and it's an honor to kill time introducing our pages.
Very appreciative. Madam Chair, my name is Simon Wenzel. I was a page last year on this committee under Chair Mariani. It was an absolutely wonderful experience, so I'm really happy to be back in the legislature again and under your leadership. And also, education policy is really exciting for me, as I will be joining the Peace Corps after this and teaching English in Kosovo starting in June. So really excited to be here.
Thank you, Simon, and that's so good to hear that you're going to probably learn from us to share with them.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you. Or learn from them and bring back to us. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ben Dulock, and this is my first year as a page, and I'm very excited to be on the Ed Innovation Policy Committee because my major in college was actually vocal music education, and I have a very strong interest in the field of education, and it'll be very interesting to hear everything that goes on.
So, Ben, do you hope to be a vocal teacher at some point?
At some point, that's a possibility. As of right now, I'm not sure exactly what I want to do, but I have a very strong interest in the field of education and a very great respect for it.
Are you a performer?
I am, yes.
And on what level of music or what area?
My main medium is voice. I'm a singer, and I sing in four choirs in the area. So.
Oh, excellent. Please tell us sometime where you're performing so we could come and listen to you.
Will do.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Simon, and we are so glad to have you as our pages. We now have a quorum, members, so the meeting will officially come to order. And Representative Lucero, have you looked at the minutes, and would you move approval if you've done so?
I have, and I will move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Representative Lucero moves approval of the minutes for January 20th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Members, today we are hearing policy ideas from traditional organizations that serve us here at the legislature in the area of education, and also from non-traditional. And some have the need to go to the Senate, so I'm going to call on them first. But I want all of you to keep in mind that we're going to limit you to 5 minutes as close to possible, and that Ethan will give you a signal at what point, Ethan?
5, 4, 3, 2, and 1.
5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Oh, my goodness. He's really going to be helping you. So don't worry too much. 5 minutes is a long time, so I've learned when I'm out and about. It doesn't fly by that fast. So please feel that you have time to express your policy. And I think with that said, and with keeping in mind that it's policy, not finance, that we want to hear from you, policy ideas, we will begin with Eugene Piccolo, who I believe has to make a trip to the Senate. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed to give your presentation. And Mr. Piccolo has a handout.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Eugene Piccolo. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Just I want to take 1 minute to just tell you about charter schools. This year there are 157 charter schools operating in the state of Minnesota, enrolling about 47,000 public school students. As you know, charter schools are public schools and are part of the public school system of the state of Minnesota. And one of the sheets that's coming around is kind of a basic primer on charter schools that has some basic information about the characteristics of charter schools. And on the back side of that is also some demographic information about the kinds of schools charters are. Most charter schools have a particular focus, in terms of their curriculum. So we have schools that are Montessori, we have schools that are art schools, we have schools that are expeditionary schools where the kids are traveling a lot and doing service. We have classical education and so forth. The geographic distribution is most of the charter schools are in the metropolitan area. About two-thirds of them are in the seven-county metro area. But there are schools from Grand Marais and Grand Portage in the northeast to Dakota and the Crescent in the southeast to Echo in southwest Minnesota to Bemidji in the northwest and spots in between. In terms of our agenda for our hopes for terms of policy, our organization has taken a look at a wide range of policy issues that affects public education as well as specifically charter schools. And in terms of our priorities for this year, one of them is to allow charter schools to offer alternative learning programs or establish alternative learning centers. There was a decision a couple years ago that charter schools could not do that by a court decision, so we need to clarify that. Second is to eliminate the requirement that MDE approve project-based learning programs. That is a methodology, not a curriculum or anything, and so we don't see why that needs to have state approval. Establish an innovative assessment for schools serving populations of graduation incentives eligible kids. A lot of these young people are students who have either dropped out or several years behind in terms of their performance, and so we believe that there should be a system of looking both at academics, student engagement, as well as their career and college readiness, so there'd be a menu of choices within each of those areas in terms of alternative measurements. Require state assessments to be compatible with different technologies, and provide authorizers with final decision-making authority in grade expansions, additional campuses, school mergers, authorizer transfers, instead of having MDE make those final decisions. Authorizers are the ones doing the day-to-day, month-to-month, year-to-year oversight, and they have a better sense of whether or not the school should be able to expand its grades, add additional campuses, and transfer between authorizers than we believe MDE does. There's also some other things, one about direct ownership of facilities, which is a policy issue, but it also has financial implications. Under current law, charter schools cannot own buildings directly, which is, we believe, a cost that raises costs to the taxpayers in Minnesota, and there's ways to reduce those costs. Also, to allow charter school students to participate in high school league activities if their school does not have an agreement or the activity in the high school league that they could participate back in their home district. And we also believe there should be revamping of the teacher relicensure to address teacher shortage areas, as well as the relicensure process, which is another whole issue besides the preparation. And then also establish a license for learning manager facilitator, where especially where project-based learning and interdisciplined learning takes place. And we also have a couple other little policy things to clarify the charter school law around who gets enrollment preference from preschool to K. That was passed by the legislature last year, but the interpretation has made it that the program has to be free rather than student attending free. And so there are a couple little things like that we also like to address.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. Members, are there questions before Mr. Piccolo travels to the Senate? Seeing none, thank you very much. And best wishes to you. And members, keep in mind that next week is School Choice Week. And School Choice Week in Minnesota emphasizes our public school choices as well as others. So former Senator Jen Olson, and former Senator Ember Reichscott-Young are co-chairs of that event. And next Wednesday, there will be an opportunity for us to attend across the street at the Best Western. So pay attention to those emails as you receive those. We are very honored to have those two former senators working together on this great celebration of school choice in the public arena in Minnesota. Next up, we have Roger Arnson. Roger represents school principals. I think that's the only hat he's wearing today. And following Roger will be Scott Kronquist from AMSD.
Morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning. Please members. Say your name for the record.
I'm Roger Aronson. I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Associations in Minnesota. This is my first visit in front of the committee this year. And let me tell you a little bit about those two associations. They include 1,800 school principals throughout Minnesota. It's almost all of the school principals that belong to the two organizations. You'll be getting their legislative platforms in the mail that includes their membership committees as well. And so you can see the names there. John Millerhagen is our executive director, who's a former elementary principal from Bloomington. David Adney is the executive director of the Secondary Association, former principal out of Minnetonka. A couple of things that we want to talk with you about this year in terms of the initiatives that are going to come in front of the committee. If you had school principals here right now, they would say, we need more teaching candidates. So initiatives that you have that you're going to hear as time goes forward, we will support connecting out-of-state teachers, making it easier for them to get Minnesota licenses, and the expansion in some of these bills have been introduced already that are geared toward expanding the pool of teachers in classrooms. We can't get ag teachers in rural Minnesota. It is hard to believe, but we have fewer social studies teachers available than we've ever had before. Used to be that a high school principal was a social studies teacher, football coach with two losing seasons. That has changed a bit now. We have trouble getting language teachers. And the pool, the numbers are down substantially. So we need to look at that for what's happening here. As I listen to your introductions here, and I have to say, Madam Chair, it gets disturbing when I have lobbied longer than a few committee members have been alive. What I did hear from members here is a lot of talk about local control. I would say that we've had several major initiatives that have moved through the legislature in a bipartisan fashion in the last several years. We are making these work right now. And when you talk about the local control, we would strongly urge you to give us some time to make these things work. This is the first year of our teacher evaluation system. It's going well. We had a three-year lead-up to this. And I might say to report back to the committee, we had a default model that if you could not enter into an agreement locally, you'd get the state model. And I'm very happy to report that nearly every school district and their local teachers entered into an agreement for a local evaluation model. Talking to Grace and Kirk Snyderwin with the School Board Association, they think there's only one district that didn't make the deadline. And so we'd like you to let us make that evaluation model work before we start tinkering with it again or changing it, and so that we can give you some results on that. We started a large bullying initiative last year. I can tell you that the reports from the school principals have been good on that, that it is working. And so let us get that under our belt and implement that before we come back to talk about any changes on that as well. The secondary principals are keenly interested in things that you can do connected to college in the schools. A lot of this relates to the certification of teachers by the higher ed institutions, making those people work with us. We had a lot of discussion about PSEO last year. We are much more interested in expanding college in the schools because the kids get to stay in the building and be connected with the activities that are going on there. Parents want the college credits. We think that's a very appropriate thing, and that's an initiative that you're connected with as well. But to the extent that we can talk about getting the teachers the certification and making the, we have a little bit of struggle with our higher ed colleagues. But those things you can really help us with, and we look forward to working on that this year with all of you. I'm in the MGRC book, which you all have as well. You can find me there, and I'm here every day as well, Madam Chair and members, and look forward very much to working with you and the members of this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Ward has a question, so
yes.
Please don't
yes.
leave yet.
Thank you. Just very quickly, I'm wondering what ideas.
People Representative Ward, I think you need to use a different microphone. I think that one.
Before, didn't
yes.
You? Try that.
Thank you. There.
Is that better?
Thank
yes.
you.
I'm wondering if we can share some ideas about how to actually recruit high-quality people going into education. There seems to be some real issues with not only the numbers, but maybe the level of people who are actually going into, interested in, and inspired by education.
Mr. Ironson.
Madam Chair and members, this is that's a great question for the committee. I think that really is ought to be one of the fundamental major goals that we have. I'm not the best expert on this, but I've read some of the data and the research that talks about where are our candidates coming from. Are they coming from the top third of their college class, the middle third, or the bottom third? You'd all like them to be from the top third. Unfortunately, they're not. If you, in the national surveys of teachers, they don't talk about going into teaching for the economic rewards. Teachers, people that are coming in, view this as an altruistic activity, that they're volunteering their part of their service for coming to do this. I could say very easily, if you would double the salary, we'd increase the pool. and you know, we all know that, but we'd increase the pool because right now we have trouble competing with nursing. You know, and these are some of the things that we struggle with. But to make this more attractive, and I think to reinforce the positive aspects of this, we lose a lot of teachers in the first 5 years. You know, so how do we keep them? It's a marvelous profession. It's a great place to work. I think we also have to sell that a bit as well. And I have a child that was in Teach for America for 3 years, and teaching is hard work.
Yes.
You know, it just is, doing this every day and being ready to go with those kids. So I think all of that's part of it. And I do think, and I know this committee has always embraced this about being positive toward them, but those are the kind of issues I think that are part of that. So if we change some of the restrictions, make it easier, I like the ideas of alternative type programs as well for getting people in. So there's a lot of creative stuff we can do. Representative Ward, I appreciate the question. Very good question.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning.
Morning.
So I really like the idea that the Principal Association is open to bringing in teachers from out of state, you know, for those slots where we need more teachers to, you know, great teachers to be in the classroom. And you mentioned, you know, add teachers in history or social studies and things like that. But I'm also wondering, would you be open to the fact that, you know, many believe that we need more teachers of color as the demographic changes across the state? And would the Principal Association be willing to support really a huge recruitment of teachers of color?
Mr. Ironson?
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, of course we would. I mean, that just makes sense to do that, and we really need to do that. Absolutely.
Representative Erdahl.
Morning. Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ironson, actually, you kind of answered a lot of the points I was going to raise, but you know, in terms of why we have a shortage of teachers in some areas, you know, when I taught at New London Spicer, we would often have student teachers coming through our agriculture program, mm-hmm. and I would ask, so where are you going to teach then when you're done here? And it was Cargill and mm-hmm. You know, places like they weren't there to become teachers. They were there to be hired by some agricultural company. And, you know, that's what we face. And part of the difficulty isn't just pay. It's the respect level. You know, the thought that people have that, well, I had a teacher once, so I can teach. You know, not everyone feels that way, but it's not uncommon to hear people say things like, well, everyone can teach. And until some of these perceptions are changed, and it's a very difficult thing to do, until we can raise the respect level that teachers have in this state and country to the places where they are in some other places in the world, we will continue to have the problem.
Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, when a young person is faced with the choice of teaching for $40,000 a year or sitting in a cubicle at Cargill for $80,000 a year, they tend to pick the cubicle. And that is unfortunate, and you're right. And our rural principals struggle to find these ag teachers. And they struggle to find facts teachers. And you know, it's tough. So that's something this committee, I think, is going to undertake this year, and we look forward to working with you on that, Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair and Mr. Aronson, I heard you indicate earlier that most folks go into teaching not for the financial incentives, because they'd be wrong if they were going in for those reasons. And we can't dismiss those, but what about issues of the public rhetoric around education? What about issues Representative Erdahl touched on, kind of the general esteem? What about issues of things like class size, not as an educational achievement issue, but a working conditions issue? Issues in flexibility of contracts and things like that that may make teaching less attractive, particularly to younger possible candidates. Can you just respond to that?
Mr. Aronson.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I mean, you're hitting on some of the major pieces that impact this. I think you're right. Give an example. For example, our retirement statutes are set up now that teachers can retire and they can then come back and work. And they can earn up to $46,000 a year. I was talking to the principal from Houston, Minnesota, Todd Lundberg, yesterday. And he has two teachers that retired last year, and they came back this year, and they're job sharing. And he said, they're fantastic. They're better than they've ever been. You know, well, why? Because we changed some of the structures that you're talking about. They feel very good about it. There's a freedom piece about that, and it all comes through. And when you talk about, I think Politico magazine yesterday reported that Minnesota is ranked one of the best, if tied for first, states in the country. And a large part of it is our graduation rate, and a large part of it was education and how positive our education stuff is, and we do not celebrate that enough. Last night, the secondary principals are holding their conference in Bloomington. They had the principals of the year talking, the assistant principals of the year. They had the Honor Society student of the year and the student council person of the year. And you got to love these people, the high school secretary of the year. They actually have an award for that.
Good.
And you sit there and think, these people work in great places. And I do have to say, I mean, I have a daughter that works in New York City public schools, and I spend a lot of time in schools. I mean, I'm the lawyer for these people, and anybody who gets to work in a public school in Minnesota is fortunate. It's a great place to be. And I do remind these people to say every once in a while when you go to work, look around, take stock of this. I have to say, too, I'm married to a high school assistant principal. I mean, we do this stuff every day. So I think, Representative Dabney, and you're right, and you've been a teacher, you know how this goes. All of this is really important. And you've done a nice job, Madam Chair, in terms of this committee celebrating that as well as we start out. So I know I've taken a lot of time.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson, and thank you for bringing up the element of time, because it is something we need to give our teachers and our principals.
Yes.
We need to give them time to digest what we've been doing over the last 10 to 12 years. And I thank you for bringing that forward.
Thank you, Mr.
Scott Kroonquist, please, from AMSD, and following him will be Josh Downham from Serve Minnesota. And members, keep in mind that we have many to get through with this five-minute limit. Make your questions really relevant and to the point. Good morning, and say your name for the record and continue your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and I do have a handout if I could hand that off to the page. Thank you. Madam Chair, members, AMSD is an association of 46 metropolitan area school districts that enroll just under one half of the state's public school students. And being distributed now is a copy of our 2015 legislative platform, which was approved by our board of directors last month. And I really appreciate the opportunity to share just a few highlights from that platform. You'll notice that the platform is organized around four main components: funding, facilities, local control and mandate reduction, and support for the world's best workforce. And today, of course, we're focusing on our policy priorities, and you'll see that those are primarily located under the local control and the world's best workforce sections in our platform. Mr. Aronson talked about local control, Madam Chair and members, and that really probably would be the best phrase to summarize AMSD's priority and really key principle when we're putting together our legislative platform. Our board members just strongly believe that to the greatest extent possible, decisions should be made at the local level by our locally elected school boards working with their communities. We just don't feel like one-size-fits-all mandates work as well, and again, allowing that local flexibility just has so many benefits. And so just a couple of examples you'll notice in our platform, something that this committee and AMSD has worked on for years is we really believe that we should allow our locally elected school boards to set their school calendar. You'll notice that you probably know next fall we're going to have the latest possible start date under current law. Labor Day falls on September 7th, so your public schools will not be able to start until September 8th. And quite frankly, I think you're going to have kids and parents driving each other crazy about that time, and you're probably going to be hearing from some of them wondering, why are my kids still here? Why have they not gone back to school yet? So another area we'd like to see greater flexibility with is in how school boards must spend money. And the primary example here would be in the area of compensatory revenue. We just think that school boards, again, should have a little greater flexibility in how that revenue is spent. They, again, know their local district and community the best, and so giving them a little more flexibility in that area would be greatly appreciated. Then another, each year we survey our board members, ask them to list their top priorities, and local control always comes out on top, but this year, following right behind that, was they're asking for greater flexibility to retain their most effective teachers. And I'm not going to speak to any specific proposal today, but we are really hoping that this session, perhaps we can find a middle ground that will allow us to give a little greater local control in this area while still respecting and honoring seniority. Two key reports will be coming your way soon as a result of work done by task forces over the interim. One on better aligning the new teacher development evaluation law with the QCOMP law. And I know, Madam Chair, that's been a very strong interest of yours, and you've done a lot of work on that, so has Representative Seltzer. And we think you're going to get a solid set of recommendations from that working group that will be a great basis to move forward on. And then another working group was the testing reduction task force. And again, we think you're going to get a solid set of recommendations there to help that discussion move forward. So I think I'm about out of time. I will stop there, but appreciate the opportunity and look forward to working with all of you this session.
Thank you, Mr. Kroonquist. And Representative Kreisha has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just quickly, sorry for that. You made a mention that and about the local control on the start date, and I certainly support that. But can they petition now to get the start date changed? So it's not that they don't have any choice in that. Is that correct?
Mr. Kroonquist.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, there are a couple of exceptions. You can apply to the commissioner for a flexible learning year, or there's also a construction exemption if you have so many square feet in your school district that are under construction. But if you don't meet one of those criteria, then you are bound by the Labor Day prohibition.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give me examples of how, or give us examples of with the compensatory revenue, if you had the flexibility to spend that how you'd like to, what are some examples of how you would change that or utilize it differently?
Sure.
Mr. Kroonquist.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Bennett. Yes, I think one key example is in the whole area of early learning, parent education. So under current law, I think 95% of the compensatory revenue needs to be spent at the building site, at that specific site where the revenue is generated. And that really just sets a really tight parameter on the school district and would not allow, for example, a district-wide initiative in an area like early learning or parental engagement, parental education. That's one example.
Thank you.
Representative Yerusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you... due to the possible pulling back of services from TIES, are your school districts anticipating any difficulties that might arise? I don't know what services they're planning to cut, and I don't know how much of that they've shared with you. So what do you see on the horizon that might arise out of that?
Mr. Kroonquist.
Madam Chair, Representative Yerusso, I'm sorry, I really don't have information for you that I feel like I am qualified to share.
Thank you. I think you answered well. Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Mr. Kronquist. There's lots to cover, but let me just zero in on one, your particular issue. AMSD has been very vocal and provided leadership over the years around school racial integration programs and the revenue. And as you know, we did a major reform to that a couple of years ago after an extensive year-long process of even asking the basic question of its importance, whether it's still relevant to Minnesota, et cetera. Can you just share a few words with the committee around AMSD's position relative to either the importance or no longer importance of the racial integration programs and the revenue that we attach to that? To be able to work, to be able to provide resources for schools to achieve those kind of goals.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Mariani. Yeah, great question and big question. So tough to answer briefly, but we strongly support the AIM legislation and the reform of the Integration Revenue Program, as you know, and we're happy to work with you on that. We think that rightly recognize that the world has changed since the original integration law was passed, and the increased emphasis on achievement while still maintaining that integration is very important. And so melding those two, I think, made a lot of sense. At the same time, it did recognize that the changing demographics in our suburban districts and just how far we've gone, and as you know, we have many of our inner-ring suburban districts that look really the same in terms of demographics as the two urban districts. So there's been somewhat of a shift maybe to professional development, education, and less of an emphasis on maybe moving students. And as you also know, the Department of Education is in the process of reworking the rule. And so we think that's an important step, and we'll obviously be following that very closely as well.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Kronquist, so tell us a little bit about whether you're, or how your school districts are approaching that work relative to the world's best workforce goals. Are they seeing consistency in terms of desired outcomes, activities, or are they treating the revenue program and the goals attached to it as separate from those other bigger, broader statewide goals?
Mr. Kronquist.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Mariani. You know, I think obviously the world's best workforce is relatively new legislation, so I think you're really seeing school districts still work on implementation and melding the integration work with the new world's best workforce requirements and the strategic plan. And so I think as we move forward, you're going to see even better examples of how those will integrate and really work hand in hand together.
Representative Seltzer, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kronquist, under your local control mandates, the last bullet point talks about reforming the state assessment system by replacing the MCAs. And the legislature 2 years ago passed some reforms, and now we're in the process of getting MCAs ready to be returned to teachers in a timely manner with a quick turnaround. I think math, that's already happening. And also, I think math is already adaptive, and we're working towards having the other assessments being adaptive also. And I'm just wondering, with these changes, why this is still on the platform.
Mr. Kronquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer. Yeah, good point. And this is an area that is evolving. As the MCAs do become more focused on growth and are adaptive, I think the overall goal is fewer tests. Is what we hear from our members. And the reason, of course, that most of them provide the map is it gives them information, informative information that they didn't used to get from the MCAs. And if we can move into a situation where we do get that kind of information, then maybe we don't have to necessarily replace the MCAs. And as you well know, so much of this is driven anyway by NCLB. And So until we get a reauthorization from Congress, we are limited as a state in how much we can accomplish in this area.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Next, we have Serve Minnesota, and on deck, we need to have the folks from Mini Mines, because they have an out-of-town visitor, and anyone who's come from out of town, be sure you alert my committee administrator so that you can come early rather than later when we might be hurrying this up a bit. Welcome to the committee. Say your name for the record and present.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Josh Downham, and I'm with Serve Minnesota. Serve Minnesota is the state's commission on national and community service, and as such, we oversee the state's AmeriCorps programs. And Madam Chair, in Minnesota, we have a bit of a different model than most other states. In the early 2000s, the legislature allowed the state's commission to pull itself out of the Department of Education and become a standalone 501c3, with the governor appointing our board. And we're actually happy to have Representative Wills and Representative Mullery as part of that board. And that has also set the stage for some innovation. And that public-private partnership that we have has allowed Serve Minnesota to raise more money privately than any other state to support AmeriCorps programs. And we also raise or receive more competitive federal AmeriCorps grants than any other state. And that's largely because we have a relentless focus on evidence-based programs. And the one that's most relevant to this committee is the Minnesota Reading Corps, which is it's the country's largest state AmeriCorps program. We have 1,200 AmeriCorps members working in over 700 schools and pre-K centers, reaching 30,000 students this school year at an average cost of just over $200 in state dollars. That success really is, and the work we're doing with those kids is borne out in the results from studies that are being conducted by the University of the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. And what I want to share with this committee later this session is to bring those researchers in and share the results from the pre-K portion of that study that will be released later this month. We're very excited to have those results, and this committee is going to be asked to expand access to pre-K programs. I mean, we've seen it over the last couple of years. We at Serve Minnesota and Minnesota Reading Corps believe it's equally important to have quality programs. So access without quality isn't really getting the job done. Reading Corps is getting the job done. I would invite any one of you to come and see the program working in your own district, and happy to help facilitate those meetings. Madam Chair, I'd love to time bank the last 2 minutes for future hearing.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Downham. And we look forward to learning about the study and what it says about Minnesota's successes. Thank you very much. Mini Mines? Oh, I'm sorry. We have a question. Representative Wills. Sorry, I didn't see you over there. Not looking to my left,
I guess. That's okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. I just wanted to say that I've really enjoyed serving on the Serve Minnesota Board over the last 2 years, attending the meetings and seeing the presentations, which we've seen some of in our committees over the last 2 years, and I'm sure we'll have those presentations on the results and the outcomes of the efforts being done throughout the state. So proud of the work that you're doing, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Representative Wills. Mini Mines, please. And following them, anyone else who's come from out of town, please be ready. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourselves and make your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Frank Forsberg, and I work with the United Way in the Twin Cities as a senior vice president there. And I'm joined by my colleague, Nancy Jost.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Nancy Jost. I work for West Central Initiative, and we are out of Fergus Falls.
Welcome to the committee, and thank you for driving so far. Please proceed.
Oh, well, thank you for this opportunity. Mini Mines is a coalition that is now made up of more than 100 members from across the state of Minnesota. It includes philanthropic organizations, business leaders, healthcare facilities, nonprofits, etc. It's a long ways from where we started with just six members 2 years ago when we created Many Minds. And in your materials today is a list of those members, and we continue to add members virtually every week. So I want you to know it's an active and growing coalition from across the state of Minnesota. What we have targeted is that we are committed to closing the education achievement gap, and our first order of business is to focus on kindergarten readiness. As we've gone around the state, we've estimated with the help of the Federal Reserve that there are about 20,000 low-income 3- and 4-year-olds in the state of Minnesota who want to be, whose parents want them in an high-quality early learning environment, and they're on a wait list because they cannot afford to be in a child care or preschool or local school-based program. So we're advocating for early learning scholarships for 20,000 low-income children. We have a visual that's part of your handout. If you look at that visual, the theory of change here is that we would like those scholarships to be directed by the parent who we think is the most informed advocate for their children. We'd like those scholarships to follow the child, so that if a parent moves across town, takes a different job, something changes, that child does not go on the end of a waiting list at another program. So we'd like those scholarships to be very portable. We think the scholarships can be used in a very diverse delivery system that the state of Minnesota has that includes home-based child care, center-based care, preschools at many of our local churches, center-based, school-based programs, as well as Head Starts. And the research, as we know, I think, is very compelling. Art Rolnick's done an incredible job convincing us both of national and local research. We've made great strides the last 2 years, but still 9 out of 10 children who need a scholarship are still on a wait list. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Nancy, who's just going to give you a little bit of a view from what it looks like in greater Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Forsberg. Welcome again.
Madam Chair and committee members, this is Nancy Jost. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the scholarships that we do have. And then I would like to politely ask for more, because right now in West Central Minnesota, as well as across rural Minnesota, in West Central, only 4 out of our 9 counties are eligible for Pathway 1. So that means there's lots of families and lots of children who do not have access to scholarships. So I ask people before I come to testify what they'd like me to tell you. And so they did say we want more scholarships, but they also said please tell them that they're good for families. It allows families actually to go to work because they can afford child care. It helps them choose high quality care. And it's good for children because it allows them to be in high quality care. Parents like them. Providers who have served families with scholarships like the scholarships. This includes family child care centers, Head Start, and schools. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in regards to scholarships in West Central Minnesota in the rural community, and parents asking for scholarship and access to scholarships, I also noticed that you're focusing on high-quality daycare provider. Is there enough high-quality providers in rural Minnesota for parents to access the care?
Madam Chair, in some places there are, and in many places we are working on that. I think we need to be working on the high quality along with the scholarships, because right now in some of our areas we do not have enough. But our local communities are working really hard to help providers improve the quality and to be parent aware rated. We're putting lots of time, energy, and effort into that, and there is a desire to do that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
Do you believe it's fair to only attach high quality care, and would that be a barrier to many parents having access to care currently?
Ms. Jost.
Madam Chair, that's a hard one to answer. But I'm going to put myself in the position of a parent with little children, because I've been there. And what I would want most for my child is to be in the best high-quality care that they possibly can be. And until that happens, and I had to go to work, I would put my child in the best place I possibly could.
Representative Moran.
One more question, Madam Chair. Is there any data or research that says that if there's a church or a daycare center in a community that's not rated, it's not high quality based on the needs of the parent of what they consider to be good for their child and their, you know, in their family? Is there any data that we can refer to?
Ms. Jost.
Madam Chair, I'm not quite, I don't know about the data, but I do know one thing, that in our local communities in West Central Minnesota, what we are doing is trying to improve the quality of care, whether they are parent-aware rated or if they're not, if they're family, friend, and neighbor and not licensed. We really have to respect what parents want and what their children need. And so we are trying to, first of all, get providers to want to be in parent-aware and help them to do that, because there are lots of them that do. And then the ones who don't and who are still taking care of children, those children deserve to be in the best places they possibly can, and it's our responsibility to help those providers be the best quality they can, because the responsibility of our children is with all of us.
Mr. Forsberg.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just also would like to interject that as we've been rolling out scholarships across the state, we've also struck lots of good compromises along the way. And so one is if a region or a community does not have enough high-quality rated programs, you know, we're still able to provide scholarships as long as that provider then enters into a preparation program. So that kind of transition, I think, is helpful. And then private philanthropy, like United Way, has been investing significant funds across the state. Here in the Twin Cities, our United Way has invested $3 million in the last couple of years to bring providers up to high quality. And there are great regional investments in Duluth and Rochester and Moorhead. So I want you to know private philanthropy is really working in a public-private partnership right along with the scholarship advancement.
Thank you.
Members, next week we will hear from early learning organizations. So those would be good questions to ask then, Representative Brand. Representative Wills, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is just a little bit in response to the discussion that Representative Moran brought up. And I can save most of the discussion and conversation for when we discuss early ed. But just a comment on licensing and maybe a question for the testifiers. When providers are licensed through the state of Minnesota, doesn't that prove their high quality? Don't they have to go through a pretty stringent process to do that, and wouldn't Parent Aware be an additional layer on top of that?
Ms. Jost.
Madam Chair and Representative, licensing is a baseline. So it's a baseline of standards of health and safety. It is not a a standard of high quality. That doesn't mean that if you're licensed, you're not, but it does mean that it's a baseline that you are meeting. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, if you don't mind,
Mr. Forsberg.
Madam Chair. Yeah, the baseline is around health and safety, making sure the physical facility is safe. It does not get into issues around curriculum, what the teacher training is or the provider training is, what are the ideas toward advancing the literacy development, the math development, the social skills of the child. These are the kinds of really skilled day-to-day provision of skill development for children that we think comes with high-quality environments. And so it's adding those curriculums, those teacher skills, those day-to-day curriculums to the daily environment that Parent Aware would provide.
Thank you very much, both of you, for coming and testifying, and we look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
Bob Waitle from
Thank
Innovative
you.
Quality Schools.
All good money.
And on deck, Steve Allen. I'm going to have you come up next.
Well, good morning.
Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Sure. I'm Bob Waitle. I'm with Innovative Quality Schools. I also
do work with Education Evolving, which is also another group that, we'll spend some time with you. So good morning, and thank you for the invitation. This morning, I'm not here to actually make specific specific presentation about bills that we're going to be bringing forward to you, but rather introduce you to a number of innovation ideas, and I will alert you to then a number of recommendations that will be coming forward from other organizations. But Madam Chair and members, it's very fitting that your title is Innovation and Policy, because the future of education really will be driven by redesign, not just by trying to do better what we did yesterday, because that will only get us a better yesterday. What we really need to do is get a better tomorrow, and that means redesign. We are an authorizer of chartered schools, and we focus on the redesign sector of public education. And even our organization is really innovative. Our organization has no employees. We have no office. Everyone is contracted, and our board is able to contract with leading people, including two retired superintendents, myself as a former commissioner, and a whole plethora of outstanding and expert individuals who then support the schools that we serve. A couple of the redesign models. We really focus on closing the achievement gap by authorizing schools from age 3 to grade 3. Now, that's a common phrase. Our administration first introduced that phrase in 1998. So if you go back and read the 1998 legislative platform, you will see age 3 to grade 3 for the first time. So age 3 to grade 3 doesn't mean a pre-K program and then somehow a K-3. It links the two together. The age 4 program is just as important as the second grade. And so that common scope and sequence does result in kids on target by the end of third grade. RTI, or the MTSS framework, is crucial to that design. And Madam Chair, if you look at the chartered schools that really are beating the odds in the urban areas, all of them are an MTSS model. And the Commissioner will be making recommendations to you in February, I believe, regarding how might Minnesota move to that model. Another example is high schools organized from grade 7 to 14. And here's an example that we can really look back in history. Rudy Perpich first launched the PSEO program. Arne Carlson, whose administration I was a part of, really jumped on that bandwagon to create schools that really merged high school and college. But only one school district, the Anoka School District, got on board. So here we are, 16 years later, now kind of thinking this is a new idea. It isn't. We're 16 years late. So let's get those career academies moving. Let's link high school and post-secondary because that's part of the redesign of public education. Schools, we focus on redesigning the curriculum. We're going to be authorized, or we have authorized a school where electronic games are the primary curriculum. You want to see kids turned on? Oh, they're turned on, all right. And electronic games designed around learning are outstanding ways to really motivate kids, as are project-based learning. We have many high schools organized around projects, and those are kids who are redesigning and really learning how to fly through those redesigned systems. You've got my handout. I want to jump down to a discussion you were having with my good friend Roger Aronson about how to get more and perhaps better teachers. We would suggest that one way is to make teaching a better job. Right now, our teachers are told what the standards are, they're told what to teach, they're told which school to teach, they're told which building to teach, they're told which classroom to teach, and then we hold them accountable for results. And yet they have very little, if anything, to say about what it is that they are really doing. if we redesigned, which is a number eight, schools that are teacher-powered, meaning the teachers make the decisions about what the curriculum ought to be. The teachers make all of the decisions, including how all of the money is spent. And then they decide what services they're going to buy from the central office, if any. That kind of school, where we really empowering teachers to be really more professional, just like your doctor's office, your lawyer's office, where the lawyers and the doctors run the office, and then they hire an administrator to do some of the administrative things. And some of my very good principal friends, including my sisters that are principals, say, ha, we spend all of our time administration and not very much time on teaching and learning. So making teaching a better job is perhaps another way to redesign and
thank you, Mr. Wadle. Our time has run out. You know, in law, we have the teacher centers already. And when I was looking through that section of our statutes, I thought, oh, my goodness, why aren't we taking advantage of that? So you have reminded us of many things we have in statute that we could take advantage of. And I shouldn't say we as policymakers, but the field can. So I'm sorry to cut you short.
Of course.
Representative Bly has a question before you leave.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Wadle, some of what you're talking about with the teacher engagement reminds me a little bit about the reform in Finland, and I usually look around to see where Representative Erdahl is in the room because he likes to talk about Finland quite a bit. But one of the things that Finland did was also to make sure that teachers are trained and get an education and are required to have a master's degree to get them ready for this new kind of innovative teaching that I think you're talking about. How might we put that into place in Minnesota?
Mr. Wadle.
Madam Chair, Representative Bly, I think that's a very good question, and I know that your committee doesn't deal with higher ed, but clearly, just as we're merging high school, post-secondary, we need to be really looking at the kinds of teachers that we really need in our education system, and to create more partnerships with higher education and K-12. So that, you know, just again, like physicians, where they spend a lot of time during their career really in hospitals, really learning that way through apprenticeships, that would be a good model, I think, for higher ed to create the kinds of teachers that we really need.
Thank you, Mr. Wadle. We look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
You're always a great innovator. Steve Allen from Alternative. And Min Kan, will you be on deck? Welcome to our committee. Say your name and present.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Allen. I'm the Executive Coordinator of Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs, an organization that's been around for about 32 years. And as I look around the room in the audience, there's a lot of people that have been part of our success right here and in various positions. Former Commissioner Bob Wadle was very, very instrumental in a lot of our educational initiatives that we've done over the years. And your chairman here on this, chairperson on this committee, was also in the early days very instrumental to educational reform with the work that she did when she was a teacher at Princeton High School. I would just like to talk about our mission statement, which is very close to what you're doing here, to lead, promote, and support innovative learning experiences. And over the years, that's what we've tried to do. We've tried to always be looking for new ways to serve our students. And as we talk about our legislative initiatives, you'll see that one of the things that we talk very much about is that transformation of students doesn't just happen. It's not magic. It takes time. And educational reform takes time. And really, that's really what we're all about, is transforming kids into becoming productive students. One of our things is we look at alternative assessments. And when we say alternative assessments, what we need to have is things that are meaningful and relevant to our students, things that will transform them, that, such as the using instruments like the HOPE survey, things that give our students hope again, or transform our students from being adjudicated individuals to being kids that are coming to school every day, or kids with truancy issues, and transforming them into productive learners. That's really the transformation process that's really much more relevant to our kids. If you look at our students, our growth model assessments are critical because we get them here and we need to take them to here. We can't take them 12 years in 1 year, but we can take them 1 year. And that's really a relevant, meaningful assessment for us. Another thing that we want to look at is choice initiatives throughout the state of Minnesota. Representative Bly last year introduced the bill 124D.085, and it's a choice initiative bill. And I'll tell you what I see that as. I see that as a legacy to all the people here in this audience and on the committee who have historically been involved in reform. And the things that you've done with choice initiatives in your school, whether it's a small school within a school program, whether it's an innovative project learning program, reform happens everywhere. It just doesn't happen in the alternative arena. And that's why this bill is so critical. And the only recommendation that I would say on it, we should change the language from encouraged to required. Because whether it's, there's a lot of superintendents are extremely progressive and want to create reform and change. And I would really look seriously at that bill. The other one that we see a lot is in teacher licensure. And we've had discussions with Aaron Doan and the Board of Teaching on this one. And this is one that's really important because a lot of our teachers teach across disciplines. Because we're a small organization, small schools, and because relationships are so critical to our students, that we really need people who can teach across disciplines and build relationships with kids and start that transformation process. So those three elements are really critical, and I'm surprised that you haven't flashed that time limit on me. 1 minute. I'll entertain any questions.
Members, are there any questions for Mr. Allen? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Allen, just very quickly, a number of folks have talked about, spoken about student assessments. Very quick answer because it's a long conversation. Do the MCAs not provide, in your opinion, the empowered information that students need for their education?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, yes and no. Yes, when we get accurate information on standardized scores in a timely manner, which we often don't, or if they're broken down and give us instructional application, then I would say yes. And it's really, over the years, that's one thing that I have been encouraged by, is I think there's less kids leaving school nowadays than there was when I first started, who can't read and who have math functioning skills. So I would say yes with the comment on it added.
And the no part?
Representative Mariani.
The difficulty is that if it's used, and you're actually destroying self-esteem in the process with kids and separating them out and really that's the part that bothers me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
Josh from MNCAN and on deck, Fred Nolan from MREA.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Say your name for the record and begin.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Joshua Crossan, and I'm with MNCAN members. Thank you. MNCAN is a nonprofit education advocacy organization dedicated to improving public education for all kids, regardless of race, family income, zip code, or background. So at MNCAN, we really support two major policy initiatives. The first is ensuring that student teachers are placed with high-quality mentor teachers. This first issue was raised by the National Council on Teacher Quality, and a report and poll conducted in part by 2008 Minnesota Teacher of the Year, Derek Olson. In the report, researchers asked the state National Teachers of the Year, how do we replicate you? How do we make sure that we're preparing the best teachers for Minnesota? And nearly all of them responded by saying, we must ensure the clinical experience phase of a teacher training program is a quality one. So just as background, before entering a classroom, teachers must spend 10 to 12 weeks in what is called a clinical experience. So they're job shadowing and basically interning with established teachers. The problem is, despite student teachers spending money and unpaid time on this clinical experience, there's no guarantee that the student teacher will be placed with the best and best prepared mentor for that student teacher. We've heard from some teachers that they were placed with first-year teachers or substitute teachers or teachers who need to work on their own professional development rather than somebody else's. So MNCAN supports supports legislation to ensure that we're providing at least a basic level of quality to these incoming teachers. Over 80% of Minnesotans in a recent poll support placing teachers with high-quality mentors as determined by teacher evaluations. And the second big issue that MNCAN is really working on is the licensure issue. So at MNCAN, we spent a lot of time and resources visiting schools across Minnesota to speak to thousands of educators, students, teachers, community members, and we've heard time and time again that Minnesota's teacher licensure laws for out-of-state teachers are out of date and onerous. So I want to start by telling you a story about a teacher named Andrea. Andrea's been teaching math for about 10 years. She taught in Texas and Massachusetts. Her Boston students actually ranked number one in proficiency and growth for the entire state of Boston, or for the entire state of Massachusetts. She has her master's in education from Harvard and is nationally certified. She moved back to her home in Minnesota, and in 2011 began to inquire about getting a math license here in the state. Currently, she's teaching special education math in Minneapolis. She's on her third and last variance license, and the Board of Teaching has not given her any clear pathways to obtain a standard math license in Minnesota. If she doesn't get a math license, a standard math license, by the end of this year, she plans to leave the state. My question for you is, are these really the teachers we want to keep away from our borders? Are these really the stories we want to continue to tell? So at MNCAN, we support a policy that would address these five problems. One, teacher shortages in greater Minnesota. Dr. Clint Willard, superintendent from Brainerd, said, "We're having a hard time filling classroom spaces. We need to fill that pipeline through streamlined pathways." Stories like these are so prevalent in Minnesota, and we need to fix those. Secondly, we need to fill hard-to-staff positions in large metropolitan areas. For example, in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis School District hired or recruited from teachers from Chicago. This group of teachers were bilingual teachers, ready and willing to come to Minnesota, and Minneapolis Public School District was ready and willing to have them. Unfortunately, due to our licensure laws, we blocked that hire, and they weren't able to come to the state of Minnesota. Thirdly, we need to empower principals to hire and retain teachers that best meet the unique needs of their students. A school administrator from Hiawatha is a public school in Minneapolis that serves kids of color and low-income kids predominantly, recently testified that his best teacher, hands down, is on his third and last year of a variance license. If he doesn't get his standard license soon, he has to let him go. And that's just, it's just baffling that a teacher who's able to prove him or herself in the classroom time and time again has no clear pathway to get a license in Minnesota. Fourth, we need to work on teacher diversity, because teacher diversity does matter. We need to tap into metropolitan areas and not just rely upon reciprocity agreements with our border states. We need to look at HBCUs, or historical black colleges and universities, Hispanic serving institutes, tribal colleges, and alternative certification programs that have proven to have large amounts of diversity among their teaching corps. Just to give you an idea of teacher diversity in Minnesota, 30% of our kids of color, or 30% of our kids in Minnesota are of color. 4% of our teachers are of color in Minnesota. Comparing that nationwide, 18% of teachers nationwide are of color. So 18% nationwide, 4% here in Minnesota, and it's just baffling to me to see that gap. And then lastly, we need to use data from actual teaching experiences and not just rely on transcripts and syllabi. The Board of Teaching forces seasoned teachers to dig out their syllabi and transcripts to prove they can teach. We currently don't honor experience as much as we need to. We need to look at local evaluations and observations, accolades, years of experience in the classroom, national certifications, and depth of knowledge of content and pedagogy. And with that, perfect timing. With
Thank
that, I'll close and welcome any questions.
And the first question is from Representative Erdahl. Can you keep it short, please? We're on a real time.
I'll talk faster. First of all, thank you, Representative Bly, for the shout out when I was in the hall. Madam Chair, and I just quickly like to say I agree with a lot of things you're saying. In fact, I have bills introduced that do address some of these things. But one comment, when you say that someone had no clear pathway, isn't a college education in that area a clear pathway?
Representative.
Mr. Cross.
Yeah. Representative and Madam Chair and Representative, yes, I think what we've seen from email exchanges, specifically with teachers that we're working with, are they have the education that's required for of them to teach, but they're not given examples of what they need to do or actually clear instructions of what they might need to do in order to obtain a license in Minnesota. For many times, people aren't told that. What classes they actually need to be taking, and other times they're told that they have to start from square one, that they've been teaching for 10, 20 years, and now they have to go back and do a clinical experience or go back to school in a Minnesota college or university. So both of those instances, we actually need to look at the experience rather than just requiring them to go back to a Minnesota college or teaching prep program.
Representative Erdahl?
Thank you. Just a real quick follow-up. Well, certainly would be interested in what legislative remedies you have in mind for that.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've been having a little bit of a ongoing debate between MNCAN and me about the issue of opening up pathways for out-of-state teachers. And on my part, one of the things I wonder about is if these obstacles exist, is it because we have specific obstacles to out-of-state people or because we've erected too many obstacles to licensure for even our own candidates within the state? And some of the shortages that are happening are surely due to that. You know, if we are discouraging people from pursuing an educational license that have a variety of backgrounds here in Minnesota. So I'd like to look at clearing out these shortages and so on from a more global perspective than just streamlining the process for out-of-state people. I don't disagree that there are certain specific needs. For example, the ability to recruit teachers of color. And we've had some discussion in the past about whether that's necessary from an educational point of view, but in one of the reasons we would want to do that is so that students have role models within their school, because that's often their only exposure to a person in a professional career. So I'd like to see us look at this, as I said, in a more global sense. Have we erected barriers that we don't need for licensure, or do we need to have a firmer grasp of alternative methods? For example, student teaching, if you have been successfully teaching with favorable reviews, we may need to have a rule. That's something we might be able to do in this committee that states that that's to be considered the equivalent of that. Thank you.
And Representative Yarusso, when House File 2 is heard, we'll have those discussions. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Crossland, so I just want to make sure I understood your testimony. Are you saying that one of the things that we don't consider adequately with licensure from out of state is years of experience?
Mr. Cross.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, I think how we consider licensure is a bean counting experience of whether or not you take the classes that are necessary to pass a Minnesota program. We need a better emphasis on experience.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Next we'll hear from MREA and Fred Nolan. And on deck, Shep Harris. Welcome. Thanks. And say your name for the record and begin.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm Fred Nolan, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association. MREA is the voice of 199 school districts and 12 education districts across the state of Minnesota, educating 186,000 students daily. And I appreciate this time to highlight four areas of policy that we'd like you to address during the session. And I really thank Mr. Cross from MNCAN for teeing up the first one, which is a silent crisis of teacher shortages across the state. This is documented in many different ways, and I know that the teacher supply report will be out shortly from the department, and I would recommend you pay close attention to that. I have not anything in writing, so we did distribute our platform by mail to all your offices. I'm just going to pull a couple things out of that, but you should have that for reference. There's three immediate actions that we would recommend the committee to do. The first is that the MTLE, the Minnesota Teacher License Exam, should not determine whether a teacher gets licensed. It should be used to describe the skills the teacher has coming out of an accredited Minnesota teacher college to begin teaching under a temporary license if they fail one or more of the MTLEs. Just a point of aside, there's several thousand teachers either in the pipeline or actually graduated who are not teaching because they failed one or more of the MTLEs. Then the hiring officer at the school can determine whether that score is adequate for the teaching assignment they're given and whether the teacher needs to improve over the course of the first 3 years of probationary teaching. Secondly, we agree with MNCAN that out-of-state teachers with experience should be allowed to begin teaching in Minnesota schools with a temporary license. So how do those folks get full license? We think that the principal of the school site, with 3 years of evaluation, using the teacher development evaluation law, using state standards, would be the one to make a determination, can that person teach? And if the person teaches, person gets a license. Pretty straightforward. We recommend a longer structural change that you think about. That has to do with the Board of Teaching. Our Federal Reserve is charged with two opposite goals. One is inflation control, one is full employment. And we trust those experts to balance those things off. Our Board of Teaching has only one goal, to have high, rigorous teachers. I think you need to explicitly give them the two goals of balancing off adequacy of supply and rigor to match the job market of teachers, because it really does control the job market. And secondly, to make that effective, we think the Board of Teaching should have representation from every economic development zone in the state. When I started as director 4 years ago, the furthest anyone on the Board of Teaching was from St. Paul was Shakopee. I looked it up. Now there are two from southern Minnesota. We agree that there ought to be a distribution of roles that's currently there. We're simply saying that when you get appointments from the governor, that they must fill unrepresented economic development zones. Then I think the Board of Teaching could fulfill both those missions. I had a longtime superintendent come up to me and said, for the first time in my career, I had to hire an uncertified teacher this year. You don't want to put your hiring officers in that situation. The second issue is the learning year. You're going to get a number of bills from individual districts to start before September 8th in 2015. I recommend that you approve them. I see no educational reason not to. But I also urge a structural change. I think you should put a working group together to really look at school time and school calendars over the summer. Figure out ways to have state accountability and flexibility that really maximize instructional learning. We're stuck in a paradigm, and you need to help us, the Innovation Committee, break out of that paradigm. And the third area is in the transition between secondary and post-secondary. It has to do with our standards. We have wonderful academic standards that prepare kids for college. But where are the standards for preparing kids for career? We expect students to learn all about micro and macroeconomics, but not about personal finance or how to earn their way into the economy. We devote three semesters to geography, but nothing about what it really takes to live in any one of those areas. So we appoint a working group to pare down the number of standards so you have room for the career readiness standards to get kids ready for civic participation and for managing their personal affairs as young adults. We got too many. You need to pare them down. And finally, this is an innovation committee. Innovation is not just about change. It's really improving the instructional quality in the schools. But where's the R&D function for the state of Minnesota? I don't see it in the MDE budget, and I wouldn't even recommend it be centralized. One of our greatest innovative companies is 3M. It's very decentralized. I would recommend you figure out a way to call for and fund on a regional basis innovation and evaluate it. Have it evaluated so that you have an R&D function in the state of Minnesota to really improve our education. Those are our four ideas we'd ask you, Madam Chair, to schedule more time for. MRA would be happy to come back and make ourselves available on those topics. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Nolan. Representative Mariani, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very quickly, Dr. Nolan, I love your recommendations. I really do. And I can speak on all of them at length, but I don't have the time. I love the R&D function idea. We had something close to that once when we had the Office of Educational Accountability. We've floated bills here to go the next step beyond. Those have never quite been successful. That's really a worthwhile recommendation for lots of reasons. The issue around the MTLE, Madam Chair, you and I have both tried repeatedly over the years to address this. I think we've come at it from different angles. But I really appreciate your testimony here today, because I think partly what you're telling us, or what I'm hearing, is that while our approaches have been good approaches, they've been too one-dimensional. We've been focused on the basic skills tests, in particular the MTLE. You're offering a way to expand in a very creative way some other options here. And so obviously to be continued, but I just want to acknowledge the solid preparation and innovative ideas that you put forward to us today.
Thank you, Representative.
And Representative Mariani, maybe the P20 is a way to do the R&D. We could talk about that. Thank you very much. Mr. Harris, welcome. Say your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shepard Harris. Go by Shep. I am with Frederickson and Byron. I've been doing this for, I think, 17, 18 years. It's been a pleasure working with members on both sides of the aisle and with the staff. Look forward to doing it with you again this session. I call this the sponge phase. I empathize with what you guys are going through because you're trying to absorb as much information as possible. So, Madam Chair, I will be brief. I actually am up here representing wearing three hats, and I think hopefully I can beat that 5 minute, make it maybe in three. So for starters, members, the first organization is called the Minnesota Association for Independent Schools. You might know some of these schools as Blake or Breck, St. Paul Academy. You might be familiar with Providence Academy in Plymouth, or the Friends School, or Shattuck St. Mary's down in Faribault, or Marshall up in Duluth. So it's a very eclectic group, including my kids who go to the Heilitzer Minneapolis Church Day School in St. Louis Park. So it's a very eclectic group of schools that primarily prides themselves on maintaining their independence. They're always watching issues, especially when it comes to non-public people aid, which is usually in the other committee, the finance committee, but sometimes policy issues will, with non-public people aid, will come up, special education issues. But one particular issue we may be working on this session, I just want to give you a heads up on, and hopefully we'll be working with the department on it as well, is that there was unintentionally, depending on your opinion, unintentionally a couple of years ago, there was a rule that was stricken from the state statutes that basically exempts private school students from having to take in eighth grade the pre-ACT exams, so that when they graduate from that eighth grade, that K-8 school, go to a public school, they hadn't taken those exams. There was an exemption for them that was stricken from the statutes. It's still in rule, but for some comfort, we may look into possibly putting that back in the statute. So just want to give you a heads up. We might be working with you on that this session. I'm going in alphabetical order here. So I went from MAIS to now MOA, not the Mall of America, but the Minnesota Optometrics Association. The key issue that they're working on this session is going to be comprehensive eye exams. Like the requirement to enter kindergarten for, you know, you need immunization shots, you need physical exams. MOA will be working. We look forward to working with the chair and with other members on both sides of the aisle to require comprehensive eye exams before entering kindergarten. MOA is pushing this issue for a couple reasons. One is that we believe it will reduce the challenges in the classroom for many kids and probably reduce some special education costs as well. What really is pushing this issue forward more so is that whether you like the Affordable Care Act or not, the fact is that one of the mandates in that is that comprehensive pediatric comprehensive eye exams are now required. It is paid for. It is not going to be an unfunded mandate on schools. So this is something that we look forward to working with you on. And finally, you heard, for most of you who are on the Education Finance Committee, you heard from Ms. Erica Moss yesterday, who's the Executive Director of Parent Aware for School Readiness. I'll be working with her on a couple of issues. You already heard from Many Minds. Passer is a member of the Executive Committee of Many Minds. This is very supportive of the Early Learning Scholarship Fund increases. But we're also going to be working with you on hopefully some reform to the Pathways 2 piece of the scholarship to allow better portability for and better choice for families. So look forward to working with you, members, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Students for Education Reform and Educators for Excellence. So if you both would come forward and be
thank
ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Following these two will be Elaine Keefe with Coalition for Children with Disabilities. Welcome to the committee, and let's start with Students for Education Reform. Say your name for the record and begin.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kenneth Avon. I am the Minnesota Program Director for Students for Education Reform. Students for Education Reform is a nonprofit organization that organizes college students around their K-12 experiences to advocate for changes to better improve those experiences for future students, siblings, friends, family friends, things of that nature. So we're very dedicated to making changes in the K-12 education system, and today we're here to talk about remedial courses, and we have Micah here to share her story and why this is an important issue for her.
Thank you. Say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Micah Bonquist. I am a senior at Gustavus Adolphus College. I'm a history major with an African studies minor. I'm the chapter leader of Students for Education Reform on my campus, as well as Minnesota's capacity captain. I'm a daughter and a sister. However, none of these things define who I am as much as the work I do with my students. From my work as a tutor, mentor, and teacher, these interactions with my students have changed my life. They represent the hope and faith I have in a better education system. They already have the hearts and minds needed to affect real positive and systemic change. I can attest to this. In all honesty, they teach me so much more than I can ever teach them. However, we are currently facing a system that is broken, a system that stifles our students' intellect through the failure to provide the support necessary to succeed in higher education. 1 in 4 students will enroll in a remedial course within 2 years of graduating from high school to get the education that their high school promised them, and this also disproportionately affects students of color. When too many students are faced with the harsh reality of having to take and pay for remedial courses, the likelihood that they will graduate greatly decreases. While this creates a hefty financial burden for the student, I would argue the more devastating effect is that which affects their hearts and minds. The status quo successfully destroys too many students' will to succeed. After all that I've already seen my students have to overcome, I'm afraid that the reality of a high school diploma's inadequacy will be too much to bear. So let's stop this. Tell our students we believe in them. We hear them, we see them, and we value them. Co-requisite courses will say just that. They will tell all of our students that even when they fall, we will be there to pick them up. We need co-requisite courses now because all of our students deserve a fair chance at educational success. They deserve to know that they matter, that we want them to succeed, and are there to support them along the way. For this, I will not stop fighting until I can promise that to each and every one of my students.
Thank you very much. Mr. Eben.
So as you can see, our students are very passionate about this. Remedial courses affect us deeply and widely. We know that because of the issues of the K-12 system not properly preparing students for college, they show up to college and end up needing to take some type of course to get them to college level. However, this is a huge financial burden, and it's a time burden. You're paying for a course that is not helping you reach graduation, as well as you're taking time that is not moving you towards graduation as well. So what we're proposing this session is a bill that talks about co-requisite courses, which is like a hybrid course that helps you get caught up to college level material while also moving you forward a semester's growth or two semesters, however much support you need to make sure that you can take college level material and ultimately graduate on time without the extra financial burden of paying for remedial courses. So I want to thank you for your time, and we'd be open to answering any questions, and we look forward to engaging with you throughout session.
Thank you, and Representative Mariani has a question for you.
Madam Chair, very quickly, I know we're running out of time here. I want to acknowledge the presence of students weighing in on these issues. We're getting fresh perspectives here, and this whole discussion of our remedial course taking in post-secondary is obviously something that impacts students very heavily, and so I really appreciate you bringing this issue forward and its connection to this committee in terms of what we do in K-12 for that. I note that under our MCA regime that didn't bar folks from passing the MCAs and yet still heavily having to take remedial courses. It's one of the reasons why we moved to the suite of assessments under the ACT. And my fear is that we may lose that under this rush to get rid of tests, quote unquote. But more importantly, I think it's critically helpful for us to hear to have you tell us that whatever assessment we use at the K-12 system really needs to be pegged to this, partly pegged to this issue of not having information early enough that empowers students so that we can avoid the whole remedial course-taking waste of time, if you will, that happens in post-secondary. So thank you for bringing forward your issues.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. And members, we have an excellent three-page handout from this group that I think you should all read and give us some input on. Thank you very much. It was great to have you.
Thank you.
Next up, Educators for Excellence. And on deck, Alfan. Oh, after Elaine Keefe. She's on deck and you're in the hall. Welcome, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning. My name is Holly Craigthorpe. I'm from Educators for Excellence. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. I'm a Minneapolis Public Schools teacher, currently on a leave of absence, which I began actually just days ago. I'm a 14-year veteran teacher, and I was also a union steward at my school. Currently, I am serving as an advocacy fellow at Educators for Excellence, which is a teacher-led organization that works locally to elevate the teaching profession, bring teacher voices to the policy table, and increase student achievement. I want to share with you my personal story of what led me to advocacy work. I began my teaching career in a large traditional urban high school. My experience with seniority and the value on seniority motivated me to find other ways where my voice could be heard. Teachers without seniority often don't have a voice, and I knew back then, as I know now, that we can do better for our students. A turning point in my career came when I was hired at a different school where leadership and power was much more distributed. I was lucky enough to work in a high-functioning, high-poverty school that where there was a respected team of teacher leaders and a variety of diverse voices that were empowered to speak up at staff meetings, and where teachers were publicly recognized for their expertise, regardless of seniority. I realized then that all teachers deserve to have a voice, and that schools are either intentionally designed for teacher voices to lead, or they're designed to oppress new teachers and teachers of color. I learned that shared leadership and empowerment is crucial to developing an urgency to address our achievement gap and to collectively own both the problems and the solutions in our school. Over my career, I have grown increasingly concerned about systemic problems in our schools that are affecting our students, such as the challenges that hard-to-staff schools face in recruiting and retaining effective teachers, the lack of career pathways for accomplished teachers who want to both teach and lead, and the lack of diversity in our teacher workforce in Minnesota. The work of Educators for Excellence is to learn, network, and take action on issues that matter to teachers. Two policy groups have convened during the last year and a half to research in the areas of quality compensation and teacher diversity. As a teacher, I was able to serve on the QComp policy team. The solutions we are proposing are outlined in our legislative policy agenda, and I'll quickly summarize them. We recommend that we fully fund teacher evaluation for all schools in Minnesota, and that QComp should remain an optional funded program for districts that are getting results with that more holistic program that offers job-embedded professional development, alternate compensation, career ladders, and performance pay. We want to introduce an option for districts to have flexibility to use QComp funds for incentives to recruit and retain highly effective teachers in hard-to-staff schools. We advocate for intentional ways to recruit and retain qualified and diverse candidates, including alternative pathways to licensure, such as residencies, grow-your-own programs, and the removal of barriers for qualified teachers from out of state. We urge our legislature to adopt accountability measures for our teacher prep programs by requiring these programs to publicly report on outcomes and also disaggregate that data by race. Our E4E members, which includes 1,000 Minnesota members here locally, we hope to work with this legislature on these priorities during the session, and we're looking for genuine ways to collaborate. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you very much, Holly. I think we're going to move on, members, to Elaine Keefe. And members, the materials that you've been provided from Educators for Excellence are excellent reading material. I hope that you will enjoy their perspective. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Elaine Keith, and I'm here representing the Coalition for Children with Disabilities. You do have our legislative priorities, or I provided them to staff right before the hearing, so I hope they've been distributed.
Yes.
All right, thank you. We're a coalition of 9 disability organizations advocating for special education issues from the parents' point of view. Our members are the PACER Center, ARC Minnesota, Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, the Autism Society, the Epilepsy Foundation, the International Dyslexia Association, the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance, the Minnesota Statewide Family Network, and the Prader-Willi Syndrome Association of Minnesota. I'm going to focus my remarks on the first 2 items that are on our list of legislative priorities. First, we support limiting the use of extreme disciplinary measures such as suspensions, expulsions, and involving law enforcement. These measures have been shown to be ineffective in changing behavior, and they're disproportionately used with students of color and students with disabilities. We support legislation that would require schools to exhaust strategies for re-engaging students and changing their behavior before resorting to suspensions or expulsions. Expand the use of positive behavior interventions, ensure that students who are suspended have continuing opportunities to make academic progress, and finally require schools to notify parents if police become involved or if a student is taken to the police station. Secondly, we support legislation to require paraprofessionals who work with students with disabilities to have disability-specific training so that they can more effectively work with the students that they're assigned to. Paraprofessionals who are unfamiliar with the disabilities of the children with whom they work often unintentionally escalate a child's disruptive behaviors. If they were required to be trained in the specific disability of the child or children that they're working with, whether it's fetal alcohol syndrome or autism or emotional behavior disorders, it would allow them to better understand and to positively address students' behavioral and educational needs. We look forward to working with you on these issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Keith, and thank you for your presentation. Next, we have Charter Schools, Al Fan, and followed by Sandra Samuels and Cradle to Career Partnership. Welcome, and say your name for the record, please, and begin.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Al Fan. I am the executive director for a nonprofit organization called Charter School Partners. Just a little bit of background about myself. When I started this work about 6 years ago, I had come from the private sector, and I think one of the first lessons I learned was how large our achievement gap was in this community, and I was shocked to find that it was as big as it was. The other thing that I learned, though, as I got involved in the charter school work, was that there were models around the country that were actually closing the gap. I had a chance to be the board chair for the local KIPP school and the local Hiawatha Academy school. And that experience gave me a chance to see successful models around the country. And my goal in creating this nonprofit organization was to bring some of those models and practices into our own community to close our achievement gap. So the mission of Charter School Partners really is quite simple, and that is to increase the number of high-quality school and school options for children all over the state, but primarily in areas serving high concentrations of low-income children. I think that Minneapolis and St. Paul have been our primary focus because that's the greatest concentration for the low-income communities of color, and we continue to focus on increasing the number of high-quality seats and schools for all children, regardless of race, income, or zip code. We really do that through 3 strategic priorities. Our first one is building and expanding high-quality schools. We've launched a fellowship program to incubate new charter schools in the region, and we continue to support the expansion and replication of high-performing charter schools like Hiawatha and Harvest Prep Network and Global Academy. Our second strategy is to build a strong community of excellence for the schools in the community that want to work together and collaborate to share best practices with each other and start grow and help each other become stronger schools and deliver consistent performance for these children. And then our third strategy is an advocacy one, where we do 3 things. We do a lot of research in your packet that I hope you have. We do annual scatter plots or graphs that show how charter schools and district schools are performing. Every year we update this information with the information from the Department of Education, and essentially we want to increase the number of schools in the upper right quadrant. That is our definition of high quality, and it is driven by the Department of Ed accountability measures. And so as you look at the upper right quadrant, there simply aren't enough schools and enough seats serving low-income children, and our goal really is to increase the number of those seats through the strategies I mentioned. So that's our data function. The second thing we do is we have a legislative agenda that's also attached in your packet. We really have four goals this session. You've heard about many of them already, but I'll just summarize. Our first goal is to create equitable charter financing for charters and district schools. We are finalizing a study that we commissioned Clifton Larson Allen to do for us that should be out in the next week or so. And essentially this study is a more detailed look at Minnesota funding for charter schools and district schools and the different sources of funding for those schools. And what the preliminary results show is that there is a significant gap between how much charter schools receive per ADM than what district schools receive per ADM, both statewide and in the urban communities. Most of the gap is driven by local property taxes. And again, we'll have that report out in the next week or so to show more detail across the last 5 years. And we think Clifton Larson Allen has done a wonderful job. We have also sent the report to the Department of Education and have had Tom Melcher review this as well. So we feel like it is a very accurate report and has a lot in it to share. Our second goal is to increase teacher talent pipeline for all public schools. We are a strong supporter of House File Number 2, and you've heard many people testify on that. We also have a goal to empower authorizers to improve charter quality throughout the state, and then we also want to provide more charter facility options for schools throughout the state. And then our third effort under our advocacy umbrella is to do parent outreach. We recently launched a site called Minneapolis School Finder. This is a pilot site in one city. MinneapolisSchoolFinder.org has information about all public schools in the city of Minneapolis, both district and charter, and quickly allows parents to look at academic performance for those schools. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fan. And our last up is Sandra Samuels and her group, From a Cradle to a Career Partnership. Members, those groups from whom we did not hear, I think, have for the most part provided us with their platforms. That includes the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, the School Boards Association, the Minnesota Chamber, the Business Partnership, and I know there are others who frequently attend our committee, and we look forward to hearing from you because you're here so frequently. I'm sure we will be able to call on you in the future. But welcome to our committee. Please say your names for the record and begin. And members, I indulge you to stay a little past 10 so we can hear from this group.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Munir Kacharamos. I'm the director of the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood.
I'm Maureen Ramirez. I'm Policy and Research Director at Growth and Justice.
And I'm Sandra Samuels, CEO of the Northside Achievement Zone.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair and members, the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, we use education as a tool to combat multi-generational poverty in the Frogtown and Summit neighborhoods of St. Paul, which are these neighborhoods located actually right here at the footsteps of the Capitol. So I'm here today with Sandra and Maureen to talk about the importance and impact of Cradle to Career initiatives, and hopefully we'll be introducing a results-driven approach and policy this session to address Minnesota's embarrassing education opportunity gap. So why should we use a cradle to career approach? So we started the cradle because we know that focusing investments early in a child's life are the greatest investments that we can make. We must focus on the proactive, the preventative work, not the reactive work that often comes too late. Our cradle to career initiatives collectively focus on kindergarten readiness, third grade reading. We know that these are both strong goals and indicators that lead to high school graduation and college and career readiness and align with developing the world's best workforce. The Critical Career Initiative policy that we really are going to try to advance this session is really trying to address, and the key word here is the partnerships piece, is that the achievement gap is bigger than any one organization, school, district, individual. So we must figure out how we work across sectors to work together so that we're moving beyond program-level results where we're working with a few hundred kids, but collectively across the state of Minnesota with Promise Neighborhoods and Strive models. We hope to be really working with and addressing population level results with tens of thousands of children in our state. So our commitment today is long term because we want to see Minnesota thrive, cradle to career.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ramos. Ms. Ramirez?
Thank you. I'm here to talk about the cradle to career concept as it's playing out across the state. It's not just an urban phenomenon. At Growth and Justice, we've been working with five communities across the state that are using the Strive Together model. Those are in Austin, Northfield, St. Cloud, Itasca area, and Red Wing. Each of those initiatives is really uniquely adapted to its own place. They're using the Strive Together model that came out of Cincinnati but has been adapted into some rural and greater Minnesota communities here. These usually include a backbone institution that coordinates a common educational agenda, a real focus on data and measurement, and again, from cradle to career coordinating services with representatives from schools, families, businesses, philanthropic institutions, and government in each of those communities.
And Ms. Samuels.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Again, I'm with the Northside Achievement Zone, and like my partners up here talked about, we too are starting to see some incredible outcomes in our community. On the handout that you have, you know, again, ours is a cradle to college approach. We were awarded a $28 million federal grant 4 years ago to do this work. We're seeing tremendous outcomes in terms of our pipeline, especially in the earlier years. As you can see over on the right, 49% of our children are ready for kindergarten versus just 35 in the zone. We're seeing increased, the longer a parent is in NAS, the better their children are doing academically. And just like my colleagues talked about, it's all around the wraparound support and a whole community, multi-sector, cross-agency, finally coming together and doing together what we cannot do alone. And so I'm excited that we are talking about really the hope of a policy being able to expand this opportunity, not for organizations per se or communities, but the children of those communities to have the chance, the same kind of chances that are happening around the country, because this model is all over, and it's really starting to show some incredible outcomes. But to have the children in the different communities that Maureen mentioned and St. Paul and so on have the same opportunity would be incredible, and we just think that it's time, and it's promising, and we have proof that it works. Thank you.
Thank you very much, you three. I really appreciate the input you have given us. Members, I'm sorry about our going over time. The meeting is adjourned.